Do you feel a shiver up your spine from fear? Yes, it's another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind. Amp up your imagination and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted. A Heart for a Heart by Ron Holmes. As I write this confession, I consider these words, which are drawn in the blood of my lover who is dead. She is without a heart. I cut out her heart. She is without blood. Her blood is from my pen. And presently there will be no more of her and me, for together we will burn and crumble, our organs of ecstasy reduced to a gray impotent ash. This will be. What has happened is over and lives only in my mind, in these blood-red words and in the screams of my wife, whom I can hear through the open doors of my laboratory. I left them open for that reason. But now I believe that I am insane. Yet I am aware of sensations more vivid than in all my sane life of fear. Now I am unable to feel fear. The feeling is good. My wife is screaming, and her screams rise from my operating table. She is strapped there quite tightly. She is conscious. And before her is the body of Stella, my dead lover. Stella is naked. There's a small hole in her forehead. In the hole is a hemorrhage, and the hemorrhage is oyster to a lead pearl. The bullet which killed her froze her breast and chilled her succulents. I can see her now, and though she is dead, she excites me. There is another hole beneath her breast. There is blood on her flesh. The blood came from the incision I made when I cut her heart out. To explain, and I must, or defile this blood, which once throbbed beneath me in beautiful delirium, Stella became my assistant only 6 months ago. While working at Strasbourg, she read of my experiments in the theory and practice of grafting human organs. She offered her collaboration, and within days we were lovers. She was beautiful. My pen is running dry, and so I dip into her blood, and now across my page I see full rich words glistening in the light of my reading lamp. I had not loved my wife for many years. Physically, she repulsed me. Intellectually, we were incompatible. Yet, with Stella, there was a union of mind and body, a harmony which endorsed the faith I had in my work in transplanting organs from one living thing to another. She lived in me, and I in her, as though we had given all in return for all. It never need have happened. I wish to record this opinion. This morning, however, my wife came into the laboratory carrying a gun. From then, the process could not be halted. She glared at me wildly and told me to make love to Stella. I refused, but then she pointed the gun at Stella's head. She repeated her wish. Helplessly, I moved towards Stella. I had never loathed anyone so much as I then loathed my wife. I began to make love to Stella. I felt her warm mouth take mine. I felt the mystery of her body. Then there was a noise, and Stella's body went limp and very heavy in my arms. Her head fell back, and blood pumped up through her forehead. My wife stood back holding the gun and laughing at me. I've tried to remember what happened next, but I cannot. My earliest recollection is one of working intensely, Stella on my right and my wife on my left. I had to work quickly. I had very little time. After I removed Stella's heart and ensured that it was preserved at the correct temperature, I began operating on my wife. Listen, she's still screaming. After my work was completed, I waited by my wife's side. When she opened her eyes, I told her that everything was all right and that she should forgive me, for I had been a fool. I said that I had fixed it so that no one would ever know. She smiled weakly, and I asked her how she was feeling. Still subdued by the drugs, she asked me what had happened. Oh, the sweetness of my anticipation. Without losing my smile, I walked across the laboratory. I had raised Stella's body on an inclined table so that her corpse sagged and her head rolled above her heavy naked breasts. It's all over, I said. These were my exact words. Stella hung there, deaf to our victory. My wife closed her eyes in horror. She trembled as though she were in the depths of a violent fever. I left Stella as she was and went over to the refrigerator. I came back with the jar. "Can you see it?" I asked. At first she would not look. When she did look, I put the jar behind my back. "You always thought you were so independent," I said. Quickly I raised the jar before her eyes. "Oh my God," she shrieked. "It's her heart." I was shocked at her ignorance. "Her heart?" I questioned. I pointed to the contents. "This is yours. It's yours." In the jar, the organ floated beautifully. Like the jar, it belonged to me. But she did not seem to understand. "I exchanged her heart for yours. It's Stella's heart that beats in your body." I thrust my hand into the cavity in Stella's cold breast. My hand came out empty and covered with blood. I dangled it before my wife's eyes. She then lost consciousness. As I write, she's still screaming, and Stella's blood has coagulated on my pen. In a few moments, I shall join the two women. I shall set fire to the laboratory because I know of anything that has any meaning. I know now that I must do it soon, before my sanity returns to bring me grief, remorse, a million emotions that I must never know. Already, I know that my madness is waning, and I must die while I can consummate my union with Stella and my wife as the flames enjoy our flesh. Give Me Your Cold Hand by John D. Kefauver. It is the waiting that is hardest. Now that the numbness is wearing off, the waiting, as one shovelful after another of earth is thrown out of the hole, as each swing of a pick digs deeper into the wet, flood-lighted ground, will then never reach the body if one is actually there. Can't they be satisfied with one body, the one that lies covered now near the hole? They dig so slowly, these poor sweating cops. I feel sorry for them. I should feel sorry for myself, or George. He stands beside me, handcuffed to my left wrist. So excited he seems about to wet his pants. His eyes shine, his large shoulders are hunched and tense, his neck muscles like thick, wet ropes. His hands easily a third larger than mine, and I'm not a small man, keep jerking unconsciously, anxiously, as if he is helping the cops dig. His beard glistens with rain. He hasn't shaved since he started hearing the voices. A beard, a body like a giant, yet he's a child as surely as I'm a man, a teacher in the Monterey school system, as surely as I am a fool named Tony. A fool. Only a fool would have let himself become involved in such a miserable mess. Only a fool would have stayed with Anita, at least as long as I did. Only a fool would be standing among a bunch of digging cops in the middle of the night with summer fog coming in from the Pacific nearby. A fool with one dead person beside him, waiting to see if another is found. A fool from the beginning, overwhelmed by a woman, although any man might be overwhelmed easily by Anita. What was not forgivable in me was that I stayed with her after I knew her evil. It seems unbelievable now that I met her only a few months ago on Carmel Beach, some 100 miles south of San Francisco on the Monterey Peninsula. Ironically, I was beside another hole then too, and death was in it. The poor bastard. He must have been a nut. Had dug a deep shaft in the sand as a makeshift dressing room for himself, his wife, and their 3 children. Childlike, he had tunneled out from the base of the hole later in the afternoon. The tunnel had collapsed while he was inside. He had suffocated. I was one of the frantic diggers who had tried to save him, and Anita was among the spectators. I noticed her immediately. Her body, her expression. She was taller than most women. Large-boned, her sun-stained body richly curved, sexually powerful. A strong, proud woman. But it was her expression that stuck like glue, that made me again and again glance at her. All the bystanders carried pity in their faces. They cared. But Anita's was cold as the ocean, unchanging except once. A smile, I swear, flicked through her cheeks. Of course, at the time I thought I had been mistaken. No one could smile at such a horrible death. It wasn't human, little did I know. The man's body was removed from the beach, and spectators gradually drifted away, speaking in whispers, as if they were afraid death would overhear. Anita didn't leave. "Men choose stupid ways to die," she said in a husky Scandinavian-accented voice. "So filthy, covered with sand. Sand in his hair, in his eyes, all over his hands. He had such beautiful hands. Did you notice?" Then, for the first time, I saw the darning needle. Glittering in the afternoon sun, it was stuck in the left shoulder strap of her bathing suit, just above one breast. As she spoke, she raised her hand, and swiftly and consciously it appeared. Stroked her index finger over its long silvery surface, as if she were wetting her finger on her tongue, or, as I came to understand later, as if she were touching her being, her soul, her sex. Anita took me home with her that afternoon. Within days, we were lovers. Even now, months later, I'm not sure why it happened so quickly, or how it came to happen at all. Who knows exactly why a certain man at a certain time jumps into the velvet well of a certain woman? Why she wants him there? What is the exact combination? Who really knows? No matter now. Too late. It happened. Eyelids pinned, ears plugged, mind shellacked, I jumped into her. She was Swedish, a blonde mountain of sex with ocean blue eyes. I ached to climb her and swim in those eyes. She had come from Sweden only 4 years ago. Most men she had known there were blondes. I was dark, olive-skinned, black-haired, like her husband, Nelson. Perhaps that was why she wanted me. Took me inside. Of course, it was more than this. It must be more than this. I kept telling myself. With Anita, you were never sure of anything. I reminded her of her husband in another respect. I had large hands. 20 years of handling footballs, basketballs, the last few years as a physical education instructor, had made them into powerful weapons. It is nice to have strong hands caress me, she said from the beginning, stroking them over and over. Nelson beat me with his. He had left her, she told me. He had gone to San Francisco one morning, less than a year ago, and had never come back. They had been married not more than a year when he disappeared. She had never heard from him again. She thought he was dead, and she was glad. He was a bastard, a rich, cruel bastard, with a $200,000 home in Pebble Beach. He beat her with his million-dollar hands, or so she told me. Of this I was sure, that Nelson had tremendous hands. She showed me a full-length photograph of him and her. He was a small man, skinny, shorter than Anita, but his hands were hams with knuckles, clubs, abnormally disproportionate to the rest of his body. And nestled in one of the clubs, completely hidden, was one of Anita's hands. I didn't see the needle the first time I looked at the picture, but weeks later, after I was beginning to suspect and fear the meaning of the piece of glistening steel, I looked at the photograph again, and yes, stuck in the front of her dress was the long darning needle, the same one she had in her bathing suit the day we met on Carmel Beach, the same one she invariably had stitched in her clothing. Why always the needle? I finally asked. It had pricked me while I kissed her. She shrugged and lightly smiled. It is mine, she said, and that was all, as if that was enough explanation for any man. I think that it was with that question that I, for the first time, saw in her eyes a hardening, a withdrawal, a shutting out, like fog coming into shore from the Pacific. And as I got to know her better, that is really possible, I saw again and again her ability to detach herself from me, and from everybody but herself, I suppose. She'd be talking to me when suddenly, as if a key word of mine or hers had unlocked a door that only she could enter, she'd leave me psychologically, her eyes fogged, her expression appearing as if she were asleep. Even in bed, after a frenzy of loving, I would find myself totally left out of her thoughts, her consciousness. Once it ever happened while we were in the act of love, she simply died on me. Even her body seemed to lose its warmth. Rejection. I felt it even from George, at first. Later, strangely, we became friends of a sorts. The day Anita took me home from the beach, I felt the man's resentment, his jealousy. I first thought that possibly he might have been her lover too, but I soon gave the idea up. When we drove up to her Pebble Beach home near Carmel, and George opened a massive front gate for the Cadillac convertible, his expression immediately became sullen when he saw me in the car with Anita. Childlike resentment was in his voice when he acknowledged Anita's introduction of me. The shaggy-haired, burly-bearded man, he was so hidden by hair it was difficult to tell if he was 20 or 40 years old, lived in a kind of guest house behind the main home. He was the gardener, the handyman, a stupid, childlike gorilla of a man who usually talked in grunted monosyllables. Anita told me she had hired him a few months before her husband disappeared. They never did like each other, she said. Nelson treated him as if he were a dirty shoeshine boy. He wanted to get rid of him. I remember the brightness that came into her eyes then. But George was mine. Like her needle, I thought later. I was the one who had found him. He was working in Monterey on a fishing boat. As soon as I saw him, I knew he was for me. He had such large, strong hands. The brightness in her eyes reached such an extreme then that I felt uncomfortable. With those hands, I knew he could do anything around the house. I wanted him to do anything. Hands? Nelson's, George's, mine. Anita seemed to gain nourishment from them, although I didn't realize the extent of what they meant to her until I suppose it was too late. Or so I rationalized, like all men must do. In any event, I realize now that one of the reasons, certainly, that Anita chose me as a lover as well as other men was because of my large, powerful hands. Her home, too, was large and powerful. Built out of stone hauled up from the nearby beach, it reminded me of a castle. Its high, narrow, triangular-topped windows, its four turret-like corners on the roof, its great wooden door with the large metal hinges, its moat-like ditch, all were the work of some eccentric during the 20s. Wind moaned through huge pines, and cypresses circled the house, except on the ocean side. Inside, ceilings were high, floors and walls were bare stone, and a fireplace was in almost every room. At night, in the main room, firelight danced on a suit of armor. Anita's bedroom faced the ocean, and there we threw ourselves against each other in a frenzy of lovemaking, violently like the surf crashing against the shore outside. Afterwards, she would take my hands and press them to her breast. "Your hands are strong as waves," she'd say. "Give me their strength." Yet once, cupping my hands as usual, she murmured, "Even waves die." And trembling suddenly, she reached for her needle on the bedstand. At night, she always kept a piece of steel on the stand. Increasingly, I became bothered by its presence. Often it sat gleaming in a puddle of moonlight, naked too. She refused to put it elsewhere, just as she refused not to wear it in her clothing. She would not talk of it. She simply said no to my request. Then please, and she put it away. I stopped mentioning it, of course. I realized her sensitivity, its importance, too late. Anita, the needle, George, hands. If only I had understood these things as I understand them now. Handcuffed to George, watching the poor sweating cops dig their hole deeper, I feel a great sadness, a loss. So much has been wasted. George, Anita, me, and yes, Nelson too. I don't know whether I'll be glad if they find a body at the bottom of the hole or if they don't. And the covered one lying beside me? I suppose it is better that it is there. Fear, it is hard to say when I first felt it. It came slowly, came back, rationalized out by my passion for Anita. I think it began to nibble on me the first time I heard George moaning outside. I was leaving Anita for the night, walking to my car in the backyard. He was behind the main house, not far from his own quarters. His voice wailed to the moon as I walked towards him in my car. As soon as he heard me, he became silent. He was sitting on the ground next to a newly planted flower garden, not too far from where I now stand, in fact. Beside him, her head on his lap, was Sags, Anita's old wolfhound. I asked him what was the matter. He wouldn't answer. He let his cabbage head drop until his chin was almost on his keg-like chest. His uncut hair matted over the collar of a ragged jacket. "Is there anything I can do? Are you ill? Do you want me to call Anita?" "No," he finally said, spitting out the word with disgust. "I don't like her no more. She's bad." Broodingly, he petted Sags with a hand as big as Nelson's. "Bigger than mine," the dog responded with a feeble wag of her tail. "She told me to do something tonight that's bad." I let his words pass. They were typical, childlike jealousies, passing angers. Once George told me Anita had chased him with her needle. I, of course, didn't believe him. Then, little did I know. "You better go to bed, George. You'll catch cold out here." "I'm listening now." His voice had become sullen. Stupidly, I asked him, to what? If only I had kept my mouth shut. It would have, at least, kept the fear from starting so soon. "Mr. Nelson talks to me every night," he said defiantly, as if I later reasoned. Anita had scolded him for believing or telling such a thing. "Nelson's not here," I reminded George. Up and down, the big man's head rocked. "Yes, he is. I can hear him. It's plain. He is trying to tell me something. He wants me to do something for him. It's plain. The next day I didn't see Sags, and the dog was not to be seen all that week. I finally asked Anita what had become of her. She told me the dog had died. It wasn't until weeks later that George, in a fit of guilt, told me Anita had made him kill the dog and bury the animal in the backyard. That was the bad thing he had been moaning about. But why? I asked Anita, angered. And yes, fear was there, too. It was beginning, or more precisely, it had started, and I didn't realize it at the time. She shrugged. The dog was old. She was useless. Besides, Nelson liked her. She reminded me of him. Her hand darted for the needle in her dress. Her voice climbed into an emotional shrillness, a tension that I had never heard. I can't stand anything. Anybody, even a dog, that reminds me of him. Fear. George waited for me in the yard one night. When I came out of Anita's house, I was already shaken. The middle of our lovemaking, while my world was driving into her, joined in a passion almost unbearable in its intensity. She called out a name, a moaning cry. Nelson, she had cried, then gone, cold. Her body stilled. Minutes later, reaching for my hand, she murmured, Nelson was the only one who could ever frighten me. For a moment, I thought you were him. But why, for God's sake? Your hands, she said. I felt them suddenly, and for a moment, I thought they were his. But mine are so much smaller. I know, but they are hard. They are strong. Quick, give me one. No, both. And she took them and held them to her breasts. For almost an hour, murmuring, they are mine, mine. Then later, George grabbed me as I walked out into the yard. He slapped a monstrous hand on my shoulder. It reached almost halfway across my back and pulled me towards the backyard. Mr. Nelson wants to talk to you, he said in a whisper that climbed into excitement. Tugging me, babbling all the time, he led me to the spot next to the new garden where he had sat before with poor Sag's head on his lap. He told me to come get you, Mr. Nelson did. He told me. I heard it plain. George, I got to get home. Mr. Nelson is talking to me plain now. Every night, he says, I want you to help me, George. I want you to get somebody for me. Listen to him. Oh, for God's sakes, George. Nelson's not here. I was tired, very tired. The great cabbage head went up and down in spasm, jerks. Yes, he is. All the time, I hear him. He says, George, I want you to help me. I want you to... Of course, I didn't hear anything, any voices. But the very fact that I stood there a moment, only a moment, and listened indicated as I looked back that I was involved with Anita and her life more than I realized. When I wouldn't listen longer with George, he became gruff, resentful, and within his anger said, She'll get you too, Miss Anita will. She's bad. I don't like her anymore. I passed this off, or tried to, as the babbling of a nut. I previously mentioned to Anita that George had told me I was hearing Nelson's voices. Immediately, alarm had rippled across her face. I'll speak to him about it, she had said crisply. You mustn't believe him when he says things like that. He's crippled mentally. Yet his words, She'll get you too, Miss Anita will, stuck in my mind like a glue sticking so well that I almost didn't give up my apartment in Monterey as planned and move in with Anita for the summer vacation. I did it, however, even though at the time I believe I knew I was making a horrible mistake. I simply could not resist her. Her rich body, her power. Power. She had power over me, perhaps as she had had over Nelson and as she had over George. Power that kept me coming back for more of her. And I knew full well that power attracts, then destroys. I was tired then, so very tired, and didn't realize it. So when school was out, I moved in with Anita. We were happy at first. We went to the beach. We took drives down the coast to Big Sur. We took in the place in Carmel and Monterey. We sat on the rocks at night outside the house. In bed, she'd take my hands and caress them, whisper to them, tell me how strong they were, like her father's. She had a recurring dream of sitting in her father's palm as a child, laughing as he tossed her up and caught her over and over. He always catches me, she said, telling me of the dream, always. He never lets me fall. The dream was based on fact, she said. Her father had tossed her up, and he had never let her fall, never. Hands, they were so often on her mind. Don't ever hit me with your hands, she told me more than once. Please, Tony, that's what Nelson did. Her finger flew to the needles as she told me, something she did whenever she felt tension, fright, anger. My father hit me once, too, with the same hand he used to throw me up with. It was the same as if he'd let me fall. Please, Tony, don't ever hit me, please, with your hand. One night she angered me. I could stand no longer seeing the needle always in her clothes, always on the nightstand by the bed at night. Why? I wanted to know, demanding to know this time. Why, in God's name? It is mine, she said, her usual answer. That is no answer, I shouted at her. I need it, she said. You have your cigarettes, I have my needle. I don't like it. Get rid of it, I shouted, not realizing then how I feared the long, glittering thing. No, she said, it is mine. I raised my hand to grab it from her dress. In an instant, as if she had made the move many times before, she pulled the needle from her dress and struck out my hand with it. The point went into my palm. Even now, handcuffed to George as the police dig ever deeper into the ground, I feel the itch where it healed. Fear, from that night, only a little over a month ago now, I felt increasing fear. The dull ache of it, not sharp, not slashing, not sudden and intense, enough to make me pack up and leave, Anita. Little fears growing. The wind was right one night, and from our bed we heard George outside in the yard, heard his repeating moaning wail. Yes, Mr. Nelson, yes. Mr. Nelson, I'll help you. I will. Just tell me who it is. The man is crazy, I told Anita. I wish you'd get rid of him. No, she said. I brought him here. I found him. He belongs to me. He is mine. The man's cries were so loud one night that they awakened me out of a deadened sleep. His wails increased to a point where I knew I'd have to go out and shut him up. As I climbed over Anita to leave the bed, she woke up, or perhaps only partially woke up. I'd never been sure, and I've thought back over the incident so many times my head swims. In any event, her eyes opened. Even in the moonlight, I could see, or thought I saw, the fear in them. Nelson, don't! She screamed, jerking up so quickly she almost struck me with her forehead. It's only me, I said quietly. Tony. Nelson, for God's sake, don't, she screamed again. Automatically, her hand went to her pajama top, to the spot where the needle would be if she were dressed. I shook her roughly. She must have been awake, yet for the third time she screamed, Nelson, please, don't hit me again. I snapped on the bedstand light. Still over her, I recoiled at what I saw. Her face was literally smeared with terror, lips drawn back, colorless and tight against her teeth, eyes like spurting fountains of fear. Frantically, almost desperately, she searched her pajama top, hunting for her needle. Then, realizing it was in the bedstand, she twisted under me, reaching for it. I grabbed her arm. Angered now, shouted at her that I was Tony, damn it, Tony. Nelson, she mumbled, please, staring right into my face. I finally calmed her enough so that I could let her arms go and get out of bed. Unmoving, she said not another word. She simply stared at me as I threw on a coat, stared at me as I put on shoes, as I went out the bedroom door. When I got outside, George was gone. I heard only the sound of waves dying on the rocks, the wind in the cypresses and pines. But just as I was going back into the house, I thought I heard a distant voice, one pained and crying. George, help me, help me. My imagination, of course. The workings of fear, the influence of Anita, George, the needle, hands, my mind, any mind, could take only so much. It was at this point that I realized I definitely had to leave Anita, but I waited too long. When I got back into the bedroom, Anita had not changed her position in the bed. Only her eyes, now glazed and dead-like, moved. They followed me sullenly as I undressed and got back into bed. When I reached out to turn out the bedstand light, I noticed Anita was gone from the stand. What did you do with it? I asked her quietly. She did not answer. I asked her again. No answer. Then I saw it, stuck in her pajama top. I turned out the light reluctantly. I slept little that night. From that night, she slept with a needle in her pajama top, in addition to it always being in her daytime clothing. I feel better with it, she said, like you do with your cigarettes. At night in bed, when she took my hand, rarely now, and put it on her breast, I sometimes felt the needle prick my fingers. She never mentioned calling me Nelson, and I wisely never brought it up. Our relationship deteriorated rapidly. We stopped going out at night, stopped going to the beach, stopped sitting on shore rocks and watching evening fog come in. Our lovemaking stopped. When she went out, she went alone. In the house, she stayed in her room most of the time. Once I found her needle in hand, slowly, deliberately punching holes in a package of my cigarettes. Fear. One night, I woke up and found her gone from bed. I searched the house calling for her. I found her outside. She was sitting on the ground next to the garden where George sat and wailed. She was rolling the needle between her fingers when I walked up to her. "What are you doing out here?" She did not answer. I asked her to come inside. I asked her what was the matter. I asked her if I had done something wrong. She never answered. Fear. I told her I was leaving as soon as I could find a place to stay. She shrugged. "As you like," she said. I began to look for an apartment only a week ago now. I found one today. I was to move out tomorrow. If only I had found it a day earlier. Just 24 hours earlier, and I would not now be standing beside a hole waiting to see if it is a grave. A few hours ago, lying in bed, we slept now in separate bedrooms, afraid even to go to sleep. I heard George wailing, even above the sound of rain. It became so loud, so disturbing, that I got up and started outside to quiet him. As I passed Anita's room, she said, "Where are you going?" Her voice cold as fog. I told her, "Stay here," she said. I did not stop. As I went out the door, flashlight in my hand, she said angrily, "Don't believe anything he tells you. He's crazy." "So are you," I thought. Outside, as I neared George, he jerked up his head. "Mr. Nelson," he whimpered. "It's me, George. Tony." Oh, the word was heavy with disappointment. I stopped in front of him and shone the light in his eyes. I'd never seen his expression so calm, so peaceful. A potted plant was in the freshly hoed garden, less than a foot from his knee. "Where did that plant come from?" I asked. "I put it there. It's for Mr. Nelson. He's gonna come see me tonight," he told me. It was plain. "Go inside, George. You'll get soaked out here." "He's gonna tell me who he wants me to get. Him and me. We've been talking a lot tonight. A whole lot. Just him and me, all alone out here." He looked down at the garden potted plant. "Ain't we, Mr. Nelson? Ain't we, huh? Just you and me, ain't we?" "Okay, okay, George. Just keep it quiet, will ya?" I turned to go back inside the house. I had enough of the whole mess. Let him wail his goddamn head off. I could stand it for one more night. The crazy son of a bitch grabbed me by the arm. "Come on, stay out here with me and Mr. Nelson, Tony. Mr. Nelson likes you. He told me so." His face shone with pride. "He likes you almost as much as he likes me." "That's good of him. He don't like Miss Anita none at all. No more," he said. Tried to pull my finger out from a grip of his firm hand. His hold tightened. "Mr. Nelson don't want you to go back inside with her. She's bad. Bad like a snake. Worse." His fingers bit deeper into my arm. "God damn it, George, let me go." "No. Mr. Nelson says no." As I swung around, trying to free myself, my foot clipped and broke the potted plant just inside the garden. "Oh," George moaned, letting me go. He dropped to his knees in the garden in mud and clumsily began to scrape bits of the broken pot together, sitting the plant upright now. "Oh, all busted. Mr. Nelson's flower all busted. Now I'll have to..." His voice broke off. Whimpering, he dropped the bits of pottery and collapsed on the ground, his forehead resting in the garden mud. "Yes, Mr. Nelson," he moaned. "Yes, sir, yes, sir," bumping his head on the ground with each word. In a moment, his yes, sir, ceased. He looked up into my flashlight beam, smiling. "That was Mr. Nelson. Did you hear him?" I mechanically moved my head. "He said, George, let Tony go in the house now." It was plain. "Don't hold him with your hands," he said, "'cause you got nice big hands, and you oughtn't to use them till I tell you to." It was plain. The man's head went up and down, childishly happy. "I'm going to help him get the person he's after. Soon as he tells me who it is, it'll be plain." I had absolutely enough. Too much. A cold horror was penetrating my bones. The sickness of the man, of Anita, of the whole house, the needle. I simply wanted to leave and go somewhere where there was warmth, health. I remember I had turned and started away from George, not sure if I was going to go back in the house and get my clothes and leave, or simply leave without my belongings. Then George said something that made me stop. Unfortunately, "Mr. Nelson is going to come up out of his grave end." As he continued talking, I at first thought his words were simply more of his babblings. Yet something like a vague itch made me pay close attention to what he was saying. Perhaps it was because the word grave seemed to fit like a key in a lock. George mumbled happily on, speaking to the freshly planted garden, unaware, I suppose, that I was even there. As I listened, the horror of what he was saying slowly jellied my soul. "It don't make no difference if you're dead, does it, Mr. Nelson? You can still come out of your grave down there, can't you? Can't you, huh? That bad old Miss Anita. She don't know what she's talking about, saying you're dead and you can't come out of your grave. Say because I killed you, you could never talk and walk around no more. Say because I killed you, you don't like me no more. She don't know you have forgiven me. She don't know I'm helping you now. She don't know I don't like her neither, like you don't. She made me do it, you know it? She made me kill you and dig a hole and dump you in it and plant a garden on top. I didn't want to, honest, Mr. Nelson. She chased me around that house with that needle of hers. She scared me bad. And she told me you was going to kill me. It was a lie. She's bad. She's worser than a snake. She's... I don't know how long Anita had been standing behind me. Long enough, I suppose, for her to hear George's words. I heard her when she whirled around and started walking rapidly, almost running towards the house. I followed her. I don't know why. I don't know whether I went after her in anger, horror, or hysterics, or some of each, or whether I was a puppet and she was yanking me along behind her by my strings, or if I followed her as you would follow a spider that you should be squashed. I don't remember the actual following. I remember vaguely coming into our bedroom, and seeing her backed into a corner, her lips curled and hard like an animal, her glittering needle in her hand, it pointed at me. "Get away from me, Nelson," she said. "I just want to get my things." "They're mine," she said. She took a step towards me, keeping the needle in front of her. "You can't frighten me anymore." She took another step towards me. This I definitely remember because it brought her within striking range of me. Felt the needle go into my hand before I saw it. I remember its sting and the white, drawn smirk on her face. I hit her. She fell to one knee and started back up. I hit her again. "Nelson," she screamed. "Nelson." She began to crawl around me towards the door. "Nelson, don't, in God's name. Nelson, don't." I let her go out the door, the needle still in her hand. "Get away from me, Nelson," she yelled hysterically as she ran downstairs. "Get away, Nelson, don't." I followed her down the steps and out into the yard. I watched her run towards George, screaming, "Stay away from me, Nelson." She fell against the man, shouting, "Nelson's chasing me, George. Help me. He's after me." "You?" George said. "Mr. Nelson after you?" "Yes, me," I heard George say almost blissfully. "Mr. Nelson, he was looking for you all the time. After you." And in a moment, "Yes, Mr. Nelson, sir. Yes, sir. It's plain." I remember watching George's ham hands pat Anita's cheek, tenderly it appeared. "Mr. Nelson says you're the one," he told Anita very simply. "It's plain. Help me, George." "I'm helping Mr. Nelson." His fingers dropped her neck. "I'm doing what he says. It's plain." I watched George's powerful fingers tighten on Anita's neck. She gagged and squirmed and beat at him. I know she hit him at least once with a needle. I saw the blood on his hand when they handcuffed us together. When I walked up to him, he was smiling ecstatically. Anita crumpled at his feet, the needle lying on the ground beside her. "I did what Mr. Nelson told me," he said proudly. "I helped him." Happy tears were in his eyes. "It was plain." Somehow, the police came. I suppose I called them. I remember only the high point. Somehow, I'm handcuffed to George. And they have finished digging. They have reached the body, Nelson's body. I expected they would. George is radiant about it. He is mumbling, babbling, talking to Nelson. The cops keep telling him to shut up. They are keeping him here to identify the body. His talk does not bother me. When you have been tortured, ordinary pain ceases to affect you. They are bringing up the body. It will get wet, I think. I turn away. I feel faint. It will get wet. I keep thinking, I cannot stop that silly thought. They lay the body beside Anita's. They have ruined the garden. The body was under it. I hear someone say, "Look at his hand. His right hand, look, it's got little holes all in it." I think of Anita at work with her needle, plunging it again and again into poor Nelson's hand, probably after he beat her with it, probably after he was dead. I hear only rain now. Everyone is quiet for a moment. George has finally found Mr. Nelson. His babbling has stopped. I hear only rain.